Welcome back to the Tailgate Podcast. I totally butchered whatever I had planned for how I was going to introduce this.
All right, restart.
All right, take it from the top.
Oh, that's so good.
I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the Tailgate.
Welcome back to the Tailgate Podcast. They say you do not lose your job due to injury, but you might end up having to take part in the three-man weave. Nick Osello, welcome back, and a special welcome back to last week's guest host, Larkin Kemp. Fellas, how we doing?
Wonderful. Let's make sure that we try and talk over each other as much as we can for this entire podcast. Larkin, do you agree to that?
Couldn't agree more.
Now, I'm going to stop you right there. You make a very good point. But yeah, hey, listen, I'm a team first glue guy. As you know, most people, that's become like a bit on social media. I actually was. Larkin, you can attest to that. So the fact that Larkin's being brought in, lesser men would say, no, 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 Terry, this is me and you. I don't want a third party. But when you have the quality, when you have the depth of knowledge, when you have the vocabulary to express the takes that Larkin has, bring it on. As far as I'm concerned, it's just another nerd to bully.
The men's and women's NCAA championship weekends are heading back to Gillette Stadium, held jointly for the first time since 2017. From May 23rd to the 26th, there is nowhere in the lacrosse world better off to be than Foxborough, Massachusetts, for eight of the best and most impactful lacrosse games of the season. The action starts Friday with the women's D1 semifinals, continues Saturday with the men's D1 semis, then championship action starts Sunday with men's Division 2, men's Division 3, and women's D1, culminating Monday afternoon with the men's D1 final. As we get closer, we're going to talk about who we think is actually going to make it there. But in the meantime, this year, Inside Lacrosse is proud to partner with the NCAA to offer you, our loyal listeners, $5 off single-day ticket options for men and women by using the code ILPOD at checkout. So head to ncaa.com/laxtickets and enter ILPOD at checkout to purchase your tickets. You know you're going to be there championship weekend, so why not get $5 off and help us show the NCAA how awesome our loyal listeners are by purchasing your tickets today. Once again, ncaa.com/laxtickets and ILPOD at checkout for $5 off your tickets. Let's jump into the most high-profile result of the weekend, that coming out of the Carrier Dome. The Orange, coming off of a loss to Maryland last week, got knocked down a peg by virtue of the Terps taking it to them in the second half, but they were taking on a Harvard team that was coming in a little bit reeling with a midweek loss to Colgate. And the Crimson managed to overcome Johnny Mullen's 90% day at the faceoff X, and they did so without an eye-popping day from Sam King. He was held to just 2-1. I think any Harvard fan would have expected that if the Crimson were going to upset the Orange, it was going to be by virtue of a virtuoso day from their talisman. Yet it was Teddy Malone who led the way with 4 goals and an assist, and 8 Crimson players scored. Part of that was aided by a overall 40% day in net from Syracuse goaltenders. Started with Jimmy McCool, he got replaced by Michael Ippoliti, and ultimately Graham Stevens, Harvard's opposite number in net, was able to make just one more of those necessary saves as the Crimson held the Orange to 14 goals and managed to hold on down the stretch when that game got tight. Larkin, thoughts on this one? No doubt about it, and we've got a lot to talk about. Larkin, before we get going, your Lady Cardinal are 6-0. Are you the hottest coaching candidate in women's lacrosse?
Yeah, so my official managerial title is the Minister of Mojo. We've moved to 6-0. We're on the road to Cuse this week. Looking forward to getting ready to roll here. I hate 8 meters. I hate 3 seconds. I like the Lady Card. That's basically where I stand on the women's game. But I'm honestly surprised we didn't do an emergency podcast for the Holy Cross Patriot League win. Looking forward to getting into that. Good to be here, boys.
No doubt. Before we get going, I want to shout out my boy Kurt that I know is listening to this as he commutes around the Atlanta metro area. In kind of in the spirit of talking over each other, the college lacrosse slate for the last month has been basically exclusively at noon on Saturday. That was not the case. We have an incredible weekend of lacrosse to talk about from Friday night all the way through Sunday afternoon. We're recording this at 3:30 Eastern time on Sunday. We just watched the combination of Princeton take care of business in the Triangle against North Carolina, Cornell come back against the Richmond Spiders, and then finally Duke pull away in the third quarter in a win over the Penn Quakers. But that is not where we are going to start. People tune into this podcast for one reason more than any other, and it is to hear Nick Acella talk about his alma mater after they lose. Nickio, take us away.
Maryland Notre Dame. Maryland won 11-10. There's no way around it. The final score was the final score. So let's focus on some positives. Over 10,000 fans played at Georgia Tech's football stadium. Beautiful weather. There are rally cries for more neutral site games, and this was a huge justification for it. To start off with some individual performances, Spanos, 3-1, Daniel Kelly with 3. McNaney is the best goalie in the country, and boy, did he solidify it with a 16-save performance, over half of those being incredible stops, momentous stops. Chris Kavanaugh with 4, Jake Taylor with 3-1, Faison with 2. Now, the fact that Notre Dame can play this sloppy, 2 offsides calls, shooting stick side high into run and gun transition, essentially allowing Maryland, who has not been known for run and gun transition, to score at least 3 big goals as they broke away in the second half. The fact that we played as bad as we possibly could means 2 things. 1, I'm not worried. It's Natty. It's three-peat season. Let's not put our foot on the panic button. Let's put it on the gas pedal. And 2 is, oh my goodness, pray for Notre Dame's team today, because that conditioning and then how red Coach Corrigan's face is during the film breakdown and during the first 20 minutes and especially the last 20 minutes of practice is going to be no joke. So I'm going to open it up to you first, Terry. I think this was, spin zone, a good result for Notre Dame. They got exposed in the ways that they needed to get exposed. You got to tighten up the transition. You got to take shots better. The worry factors for me are that we don't have a lethal threat outside shooter that could beat McNaney. And it's almost a role reversal of the national championship last year. Notre Dame's defense was able to pack it in. They could play aggressive if they wanted to, but they said, you are going to have to beat us outside. The amount of force feeds inside to Jake Taylor and the other Notre Dame attackmen that were unsuccessful only alluded to the fact that they were uncharacteristically shy to try and pump it in from range. And it really showed so in shot placement and in transition going backwards. How worried should I be, and how good of a sign and a result for this was Notre Dame?
Well, I agree with you that you should be very worried about the health and safety of the team the next time they take the field at Arlotta. The post-game interview with Kevin Corrigan lasted 1 minute and 7 seconds. I asked 5 questions. There were 2 F-bombs. So yeah, he was not pleased. Not pleased is probably the way to describe it. It's actually funny. The voice memos app on my phone rejected it. I can't even play it. I was able to listen to it once, and I think it was so hot. It was like a Mission Impossible recording. I can't even access it anymore. But going into the game, I was of the opinion that we were going to learn more about Notre Dame than we would about Maryland. Maryland had already played a bunch of really tough games. I felt like the thing that we were going to learn about them, and you know, I've said this for 3 weeks at this point, is how they continue to evolve. And they're not going to evolve as rapidly after a win as they will after they lose, assuming at some point they lose, which at this point might not be a good assumption. Whereas for Notre Dame, you know, this was their second stiff test in a row, and you know, an even more significant kind of uptick in quality of opponent. And for me, I just, you know, you can get so much from watching games, and I think it's because when I'm in person, I'm just so much more attentive than when my focus is split between 2 or 3 screens. But I have benefited so much from the 3 games that I've covered in person. And specifically with this one, it was, and I'll get to the atmosphere in a second, but just, I didn't really kind of intellectually understand exactly how inexperienced Notre Dame was. Because one of the reasons that Notre Dame and Syracuse were very justifiable preseason number one and number two was because they brought back so much talent. And certainly when you look at Chris Kavanaugh and Jake Taylor, it's hard to have a more experienced duo at attack than those two do. With Jordan Faison and Sean Light, you had two freshmen that were absolutely awesome. Ben Ramsey, you know, I think I had him as like the preseason number seven player in all of college lacrosse two off seasons ago. And so there was this core of returning experience that, while it wasn't like so all encompassing, because certainly they graduated a ton of awesome players last year as well, it was still more than what it felt like a lot of the competition was going to produce. But then, you know, watching this, they have a third attackman who has basically no experience. Their second, third, and fourth short stick defensive middie after Tyler Buckner went out, and kind of even counting Tyler Buckner, are all new. Their second and third defensemen and their goalie. So that's at least seven before you count their top two lines of midfielders, which, depending on how you feel about, well, certainly Matt Jeffrey has no experience, and he didn't even have a fall. And, you know, how much experience are you going to give to Fisher Finley and some of these guys that Max Buzenkel that were kind of on the third line but actually ran a decent amount last year? The point is that there is a lot of built-in improvement in Notre Dame on the basis of experience alone. But specifically with that third attack spot, a lot of it is going to – you can't assume that it's going to come is basically what I'm trying to say. Like, they're going to have to figure out a solution. And the thing that I think is most notable is that the obvious solutions for that third attack spot, generally speaking, are off-ball players. And that's considerably different from what they had when they had Pat and Chris Kavanaugh, particularly for what it means for Jake Taylor, the space that he has to do the dark magic stuff that makes him so effective. The question I'm asking is Brady Piccone's presence on the field, because of the space he's supposed to occupy as the third attackman, as opposed to the space that Devin McClain occupied when he was a midfielder, right? Like, so much of why Notre Dame's top six worked offensively last year is because you had four guys who you were comfortable with the ball on their stick, drawing a slide, making something happen, and then two guys in Taylor and McClain who were virtuoso at either creating space, making life difficult for the defender that was trying to guard them, and then when they were called upon, either, you know, Jake Taylor is an excellent cutter, but I conceive of him as a, I'm going to catch the ball with my feet set and immediately get rid of it, whereas Devin McClain is much more of a cutter. I conceive of him as, I am going to cut to the ball, catch with my feet moving, and shoot and score. That's why their offense was the number one offense in the country. You can react to both sides of the ball. The one thing you can't react to, by the way, is Will Lynch. He's awesome. Nick, remember when we started this podcast and you were afraid?
Yeah, you were like, so negative about him, and I'm like,
yeah, oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's how it
happened. Yes. So the point is that, you know, right now these are probably two units that are right around 8 to 12, right? And that's good. You know, they've only played two quality opponents, and they, you know, didn't really get tested in their other two games. And so there's just a lot more that's built into it. And it's weird because, like, to an extent, it's not that different from coming away from their Georgetown game last year. In many ways, it's a lot better because it's Maryland and it was, you know, neutral site as opposed to Georgetown at home. So in those ways, you should be optimistic. But, you know, I look at it and I say, I mean, Mark Larkin, maybe this is kind of where you were ready to go, and I'll turn it over to you. But, oh my God, Maryland. Oh my God, John Tillman. Oh my God, Maryland coaching staff.
It was the Tillman masterclass, and I'll touch on that in a second, just to double down on some of those points. I think the upside case for Notre Dame, Nick, is you look at the shots, you look at the ground balls, and obviously the face-off percentage. So I think ultimately at like 30,000 feet, the road to three-peat, I actually would say, is easier if you get clipped during the regular season just to like redial in and build diversity in the room. But I think, and it's a point Terry just touched on with respect to some of the off-ball detail, I do think at times we didn't give Pat Kavanaugh the benefit of the doubt with respect to his dynamic nature behind the cage. And what that does, just the entire defensive midfield having to take half a step down and how that impacts approach angles when the ball spins and difficulty in two rotations. So I do think we're seeing just the fundamental thesis that, like, Liam Entenmann was really good. Pat Kavanaugh was really good. The rest of Notre Dame is also elite, but, like, losing two players, two of the best players to ever play there, I do think leaves them slightly more exposed. Like, I think, you know, anytime the best roster also has a first-team All-American goalie, it's just so hard to beat them in May, specifically on a short clock on championship weekend, just with respect to, you know, kind of the overnight nature of that scout. So, I, you know, if I had a media poll vote, I think Notre Dame would still be my one, but I do believe you know, heading forward, I was concerned just about the lack of parity in that they would just kind of almost blow through the competition. I think what we've seen from Tillman, his ability to prepare that roster, the implications on Maryland potentially being a one seed if they can kind of just keep rolling here. I do believe that, you know, the narrative is back open with respect to, you know, we have competition in college lacrosse this year. I think we're starting to see things from teams down the table that, you know, when you consider some of the dynamic athletes on a UNC or a Princeton, you know, can Notre Dame get beat in May? I think I'm now open to that question, which is exciting for me.
So, did you have anything else? Because I kind of have a different point that I was taking away from this game.
No, I don't
want to cut you off. So the biggest difference for me, I usually kind of hone into a couple different pillars as I watch a game and I'm trying to take away from it. And the dodging and shot placement, I have worries and question marks about, you know, Ricardelli, because the low angle shots that Maryland was able to consistently score on raised a couple eyebrows. It's too early to judge, but 7 seconds left in the shot clock. We're pushing them, generally speaking, we being a defensive midfielder or a midfielder up top, pushing them to low angle shots that went in so much so that it's going to toy with the defense's mind and say, hey, 7 seconds left. Now we're going to have to press out even further and give up those skip passes that we also saw late in the shot clock. And I think that was more of a vehicle of questionable shots going in that may or may not be tightened up. But if they aren't tightened up, that is a huge red flag and the only red flag that I see Notre Dame carrying throughout the rest of the season. And I feel like Maryland put a great blueprint to beat Notre Dame from a midfield initiating perspective, because there were dodges, especially kind of above the top, that were being picked up inside the box. And as we talk about lack of, you know, the graduating talent, the Eric Dobson that could get a full head of steam, plow through everybody and get a shot off from 12 to 15 top center. Maryland just, it seems to me, and I'm probably going to go back and rewatch this game, they were happy pressing out a little bit further on adjacents as the dodge was initiated, while picking up closer to the box or sometimes even inside the box, so that anywhere Notre Dame was dodging, it was just a traffic jam wherever their momentum was taking them. So the low angle shots for Maryland going in, which has that trickle down effect through the rest of the defense that Entenmann 1,000% prevented last year, and the lack of the momentum of the dodge being able to take you to space. If I'm a defense and I'm scouting Notre Dame, pack it in and make their dodges, like, take away their athleticism. You know, Faison gets a step and sometimes he can get a shot off. He had 2 goals in the game, but more often than not, he had 3 yards of room to operate before there was someone right in his face.
So I kind of took the opposite takeaway from this game as you did with respect to, you know, for me, Notre Dame defensively, the thing I'm going to track is their short stick D midfielder development, because I felt like I could, you know, feel a relative drop off from, you know, Ramsey, Nick Harris, Carter Parlett last year to Ramsey, Christian Alakwa, Thomas Perel, and then after Buckner went out, Chris Reinhardt. There was one sequence when it was a Maryland midi swimming a short stick up top, slide comes, bangs it basically adjacent to another midfielder with a short stick closing out, and it was just an easy split and score. And it felt like, you know, so that's why your point is well taken insofar as low shot clock, attacking a shorty pushing the shooter to where you want him to be, and then the save not being made puts pressure on the way that the defenses are going to approach those situations. But I also think the opposite is true, where it's like when you get beat that cleanly, you can't expect the goalie to make the save. And then all of a sudden you have to, as the long sticks, and Larkin can speak to this better than anybody. Although Nick, I suppose you got slid to a lot, so maybe you can speak to it really well as well.
Bang.
But then it's just a question of when do we go and how prepared do we have to go in these situations? So, but you know, talking to the staff post game, they're optimistic about the athleticism of their short sticks. It's just experience. And so that's why charting the development over the course of the year is going to be so important.
It's awesome. Not a short stick Dimitti's job to stop the ball carrier. It's the short stick Dimitti's job to slide and recover efficiently. I was happy to get beat because I'm going to go find my next guy. And then the offense is going to say, gosh, we're beating these shorties up top, especially that fat one that got trapped. How can we not find anything after we beat the slide guy? And I think Maryland might be onto something. I hadn't really seen this defense being played. Larkin, correct me if I'm wrong, but they almost like, hey, let's pack it in. But when they start initiating on the outside of where we packed it in, let's be very aggressive. And I mentioned pressing out on adjacents, but man, it just seemed like there was no space for Notre Dame. And I was trying to think through it. And I'm like, pack it in because you got a great goaltender. And then when they initiate, you can just slide and get into that space. The amount of force feeds inside that were collapsed on, not just by the backside guy, but like two backside guys. I had never seen that, the ease with which they collapsed on the feeds to the crease, constantly had more than one backside guy doing it. Larkin, I might be taking this to the Bishop Kelly Knights playing Boise on Tuesday as their assistant D coordinator.
Well, I think what Jesse and Tillman have done for so long, which is best in class, is they like identify early in the week, like who and how they want to give up goals. You know, they look at it and it's like, hey, you know, Pat Kavanaugh's gone. Taylor, CK, Devin McClain, three of the best off-ball players in the country, if not, you know, of the last decade. Let's condense slides, both in terms of length and also in terms of, like, slide frequency. Let's put our short six on kind of more isolated islands, at least early, to see if they can hold up. And let's find out what some of these, you know, while highly rated recruits and on paper good athletes, let's see what some of these more inexperienced, to Terry's point, which I think he nailed, players can do with respect to both gaining leverage and like having very limited time to make split second decisions about where the ball's going. I mean, I think, and then to flip sides of the field, what Tillman does better than anyone, and I think it's such a good lesson for coaches at all levels, is lacrosse coaches fall in love with this notion of flow and like making the ball sing. And what John does such a good job of, and it was so easy to isolate back in the pre-shot clock era, is he actually identifies both the on-ball short stick defensive player, but also the slide decision maker that are circled mid-week of both being inexperienced that he wants to have to make basically like spatial decisions about hedge and recover. And the game just breaks down into full, you know, basketball isolation of like 2v2s, 3v3s, a lot of push-pulls. Like it's, sometimes we all think that we're going to be able to play like indoors nations, the ball is going east-west. Like, you know, if you don't have the athletes to do that, which, you know, Maryland does not have like a Chanichuk or Wisnowskis this year. So I just tip my cap to them. Like, I'm really happy for Dales on a human level. And like, Maryland is very good. Shocking.
I want to come back to that point about flow, because I do think that there was a game script element to this where the first half was very settled offense oriented, and Maryland was able to go toe to toe, right? They were trailing by one at half. The second half, and Nick, you hit on it, but like just their willingness to run in transition and get scores was important, which is an obvious statement, but if you know what we're talking about, you know that that's not something to be taken for granted with this staff and with this program. But before we get to that, I need to shout out Will Schaller. For three podcasts in a row, we've talked about, or since the Syracuse game, we've talked about Maryland sinking their teeth into the narrative of only having one preseason All-American. And again, you know, there are a lot of reasons that go into that. And I just question, like, all right, if not, who do we miss? And it's not on the basis of who did we miss, like, this, you know, whatever. Will Schaller is going to be a first-team All-American in midseason, right? That is why we do that exercise. And, you know, again, talking to the Notre Dame staff postgame, they were like, he played Chris as well as anybody has played him in a very long time. But even then, like, that was not the part of his game that I most reacted to. There is a sequence in the, I guess it would have been, I can't remember whether it was in the third or fourth quarter, but it doesn't matter. Either way, Maryland loses the ball on the clear. Matt Jeffrey comes up. McNeely's out of the goal. So he's got like a 30-yard line to an empty net. And he makes an interesting decision, which is to dive and then shoot. But he's counter-met by Will Schaller, who dives backwards and manages to get his hand on the ball. And he's like, at this point, 15 yards away from the goal. It like caroms off in a 45-degree. Notre Dame retains possession. They basically have a full shot clock. They run a possession. Jordan Faison gets the ball in the middle of the teeth of the defense. If Notre Dame scores in this situation, like that empty shot clock momentum play, or I'm sorry, empty net momentum play, just you know, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't build on anything. Scheller dislodges the ball from Faison, picks up the ground ball, throws the hit ahead pass to AJ Larkin, who then hits Daniel Kelly in transition for one of these fast break goals that we're going to talk about. And it was just an exceptional sequence. But then the other play that really stood out to me, we haven't mentioned this. Notre Dame cuts a 10-7 Maryland lead to 11-10, wins the faceoff. Will Lynch finished, I think, like 16 for 22. I think Notre Dame finished 18 for 24, somewhere in that neighborhood. And calls timeout. Kavanaugh had a look with about 45 seconds left. By the way, Matt and Pat were both on the sideline. I was standing next to them in this final sequence. I don't know if Brennan was there, but he was probably coaching. Chris missed the pipe by like an inch or two. I mean, it would have been an absolute stinger if he had hit it. They back it up. They get another look. And then really good action ends up with Chris one-on-one with McNaney. And McNaney makes his 16 save, kick save. But the ball comes out towards the near sideline where all the media is. And the Notre Dame offensive player, his momentum was going the opposite direction, but he had the basically head start on winning the race to the end line that would have gotten Notre Dame the ball back with like 20-ish seconds left on the game clock. Schaller, incredible acceleration to win the sideline run out and ultimately ice the game. So those were three plays that stood out to me. I mean, that it probably wasn't a four-goal swing, but you can make an effective argument that that was a three-goal sequence in just those two, you know, those two plays. And in a one-goal game, those matter a lot. So, Larkin, those were hockey plays, and he was a hockey player. So
I was actually about to say that. It's such an emotional lift to your team, both in the way in which you practice and how you respond in-game. When you have one of your top, like, cover athletes is also, like, getting big in shot lanes. He has a full hockey style approach on downers to like trying to get a piece, which is so rare in lacrosse. Like there are guys who are very good with the head of their stick, getting, you know, knocking shots down. He is intentionally like getting massive, trying to wear it. It seems like once or twice a game he has just a NHL level play with respect to like a 2-on-1 getting a piece or using his body. And I think in terms of just like the emotions in the room and having him be able to hold people accountable. And like for some of those younger guys on offense, when he's telling you at halftime to get leverage and get downhill, like it probably means something. And that's the exact type of leadership recipe you need to go beat a generational group like this Notre Dame three-peat. So makes all the sense in the world. Kid deserves, you know, all the flowers that are coming his way and love watching him ball.
Well, and when he made that stop, the, you know, the save with his hand, if I do that, I'm immediately standing up and doing like the "Are you not entertained?" He was trying to run out where the ball ricocheted to. Like the fact that he didn't even take a second to say, "Yeah, look at me, I just made a save on an empty net." He's just like, "Nope, I'm going to get the ball." It was one of the most impressive defensive performances I've seen in a long time. I mean, I'd have to go back to the vault, 2016 Brown, to even, you know, try and find something.
Oh yeah, we were known for fundamental defense for sure.
But that brings up it's a nice segue to the last thing that I wanted to talk about before we got to talk about the fact that this game happened in Atlanta. The Maryland transition and Nick, go. I want to start with you first. How upset were you by Notre Dame giving that up versus Larkin? I want you to speak to how impressed you were by Maryland's like willingness and decision-making in offensive transition.
Poor decision-making in transition for Notre Dame, especially on the defensive side. So that one, I think it was it Spanos that threw that fake underneath and then score the goal? There were multiple, we're going to slide two guys to the pole streaking downfield with a trailer. We talk about what do we want to give up, and that's always, you know, the risk reward. What is the risk of sliding to the pole? And well, the risk is, you know, giving up a shot by the pole. If you slide, the risk is now him moving it to the ball scores. And it just seemed like there was no real, Coach Corrigan always used the term calculus, where he's like, guys, it's not calculus. But he would always use that in reference to like the decision making of, do we slide and take away the pole? Who's their shooter? Do they have, you know, some guy with a cannon up top? Do we slide quickly to him? Is their goal scorer the second pass and we make that rotation quick? And it just seemed like there was never real any cohesive understanding from the defense on, hey, let's take away the pull because he's a goal scorer versus, you know what, if he has a trailer, that's what we're giving up because he's going to have a wind up and we'd rather have the chance at a back check versus getting that into the two right-handed attackmen. It just seemed like, and maybe to Maryland's credit, they were like, hey, we haven't put any transition on film. Let's put our foot on the gas this time. I don't think that was the case. I think that's just how the game happened to play out. But expect Notre Dame's transition defense to be at least more on the same page, where there's not two guys sliding to a pole, where there's not commitment to taking something away that actually puts you in no man's land, and now you're not taking away the streaking pole or the first pass up top. So just poor decision-making all around, particularly on defensive transition.
Yeah, so I think to answer specifically in terms of transition decision-making, I think appetite for transition. So if we're in the Maryland staff room, there's two kind of like foundational bullet points. One is, what is our opinion of our opponent's base defense? So how does our efficiency, you know, decay in real time if Notre Dame gets the six players they want on the field, or whoever Maryland happens to be playing? The second, which I think is the more interesting bullet point specifically for Tillman over the years, is if you believe that in settled sixes, you have one midfielder per line and or an attackman, that if you put in a big little or a razor, he will, no matter what, draw a slide and or generate leverage, the appetite for like 5v5 unsettled early offense, it looks on a, you know, loss ratio basis, it looks a little less interesting to someone like John over the years. I think what we potentially may see this year about their willingness to speed it up. Yeah.
I just want to jump in there to make it a little clearer for folks that might not have fully followed. Think about when Loyola won the national championship in 2012, how fast-paced they were and how willing they were to play early offense, very much like a Matt Dwan-influenced system. And then think about how they basically did not run once they had Pat Spencer, because what's the point in trying to play early offense if Pat Spencer's not going to touch the ball? You need a generational player to touch the ball basically every time down, and so as a result, you're not going to play fast offense.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And to build off that, the Loyola metaphor, I guess kind of the sub-bullet is, there is a world in which Tillman actually thinks quite highly of some of his defensive athletes in kind of their back-to-front decision-making. You know, so much of it is, as long as when they inevitably draw, because they will draw, right? If they can hit a single, whether it be to an AJ or the appropriate skip, like if you gun to head, trust him to do the right thing and not just like do what Osello basically did, which is pull up from 18 and try and kill a gopher on a bouncer, like it transition offense becomes highly compelling. And it's the reason that if you track the NFL, teams are getting faster and teams aren't allowing defenses to sub, right? It's quite literally that simple. It's a tired linebacker on a skilled running back. And that's why I think it's very unfair and unfortunate when certain coaches get labeled as like, I want to go fast versus slow. Like, ultimately, it's all personnel based. And you will see the best coaches kind of transition in between the two.
I killed so many gophers, but it was fun. Larkin, 2016 Outlaws, you're telling me we didn't have fun in transition drills? You're wide open on the crease, and I'm saying, hey, duck, this is hitting the moon? Like, yeah, come on.
As you're looking off, Eric Law, one of the best.
Yeah. Like, Eric, I got this. Yeah. Stay right there. I hit one, though. All right, I think we've exhausted the Maryland-Notre Dame as much as I'd like to stay on topic and just riff on the alma mater. Terry, one more point?
Yeah, Bobby Dye Stadium.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah, so I really wanted to go to this game as soon as it was announced, because when I was in college, my college roommate he literally has a fetish for the triple option. And so whenever we would play the NCAA video game, he would play as Georgia Tech. And so I would, you know, be Notre Dame or Ohio State or whatever, and we'd be playing in Bobby Dye. And I was like, the way the Atlanta skyline is in the back of this stadium is so cool. It's like very uncommon for a college football environment. And so ever since then, I've been like infatuated by it. And then I went to Atlanta for a wedding like 10 years ago. We went to the Varsity and I walked around the stadium. I was like, this place is sick, but we didn't go in. And so as a result, I've always wanted to go there. And, you know, the fact that it was one versus two, the fact that it was this matchup, I was always going to be there. But let me tell you, man, I stayed walking distance from campus. And when I went over, probably about like 11:30, so 90 minutes before game time, there were lines to get in. And I knew that they had pre-sold 7,000. And so, I knew it was going to be a good walk-up because of the weather. But at the same time, like, it's a neutral site game. Like, there are Notre Dame fans in Atlanta, but they're not Georgia Tech students. You know what I mean? Like, they didn't have to, they didn't get to rely on what so often happens with, you know, when you see the Notre Dame football team going crazy on Hillside, literally in this Maryland game last year. That was when Faison had three, that was the game. But they were like, they were just there, right? They didn't have that luxury. So yeah, I thought 1500, right? Like, set the over under at 1500. And then by like the middle of the second quarter, I was like, no, this is going way over 8,500. And yeah, congrats to Jason Breo and his staff for pulling it off. It was a great day for lacrosse in the South. It was a great day for folks from Atlanta, and, you know, couldn't be happier for them.
Just to build off that and use a little bit of my like personal work experience, the WWE and TKO now, I think, do a great job of like looking at their premium live event calendar from, hey, what markets do we want to take our product to? And when can we schedule it so it's not competitive with other things that are, you know, highly important, football being the best example, and we can like pre-predict the weather pattern. And I think I would like urge all athletic directors and coaching staffs to get more open to this notion that we see all the time in college basketball, where it's like four teams will just agree to go play in a cool city, and they'll play Friday, Sunday, and they'll do round robin style. And I think it's actually a great transition, because what we saw from Penn and Princeton, you know, being invited and playing in Durham and North Carolina and Chapel Hill this weekend, I would love to see more of that. I think coaches protect their downside because they want a week to prep. But, like, it makes all the sense in the world if Carolina's going to come play Yale or something, drive an hour north and play Brown on the way home, right? Like, this is a sport with limited travel budgets. They don't want to buy tickets every week unless you're Stanford and we can afford it. But ultimately, like, these are high-level athletes who can recover. You don't really need 7 days. And I have a ton of respect for John Donowski and his willingness to play those kind of, you know, two a weekend. And I wish more people were open to it, because I think the concept of sending four huge brands to a Salt Lake or to Ohio or to Atlanta or to Boston or wherever it may be, it becomes way more interesting. And I think you'd start to see those five-figure numbers in terms of attendance, a gate, and hopefully television ratings as well.
Yeah, no, that's a great point, Larkin. You know, let's really shake it up and have more big games in the Northeast. That's a take that I think we were all, you know, sitting on the edge of our seat.
More question for you, Sal. Do you think if Harvard Stadium hosted Notre Dame, Maryland, Duke, and, like, Carolina, the winners play on Sunday? You think that'd be pretty interesting?
I don't think it would sell as better, you know, not as good, if not worse, than a place like Boise, Idaho, you know. There's a lot of good, a lot of starved lacrosse fans out there. Do we need to overload the elite Harvard crowd, or can we show some love? So that's why I think Atlanta was a great, great destination city. I think get Brown out of the Northeast. There's a whole country west of the Mississippi, Larkin. Maybe you should do a little traveling yourself. Come and visit me. Anyways, Princeton, North Carolina. Tigers. They took down the Tar Heels 14-12 coming off the heels of a 15-14 win against Duke. We'll touch on that game in a little bit, but great back-to-back wins. Again, we'll touch on Duke in a second, so let's focus on the North Carolina game. Balanced offense from Princeton. Palumbo with 4-1, but there were eight other players for Princeton that got on the score sheet. For UNC, Duffy and Petro with a hat trick apiece. Back-and-forth affair. No team led by more than two the entire game. So no team was able to break away. There were moments of, this could be a good run. And every single time there was a run, it was immediately thwarted. Terry, Princeton, North Carolina, what do you got? And you're on mute.
Congrats to the Tigers. Obviously disappointing coming off of a loss to Maryland last weekend to go 2-0, but really this, they survived, you mentioned it, but they survived, you know, two close games and did so in, to Larkin's prior point, adverse circumstances from the standpoint of recovery. If I'm going to like pull back a little bit and talk about I just can't get over Princeton's roster construction, particularly from recruiting. And it's funny because like one of the players who I now have a really strong reaction to is a walk-on from the football team, and we'll get to him in a minute. But I mean, holy cow. Like, so there are a couple of factors, and Larkin and I touched on this last week a little bit with respect to how within the Ivy League you have to forge an identity from a recruiting standpoint. And the way in which I have diagnosed how specifically Brown, Princeton, Penn, and Harvard have recruited over the course of the last several years is, you know, very much kind of like similar in their target pool, whereas Cornell and Yale have both been very distinct in their target pool. Princeton has just won the battles by and large in both ways in terms of, you know, the fact that getting Nate Kibiri brings Colin Burns with it, it would appear. I don't know that to be the case, but it would certainly appear. And then there are other, a lot, you know, really interesting stories of guys that, you know, maybe weren't as highly recruited at the outset and then subsequently became very sought after, guys like Chad Palumbo and John Dunphy and Cooper Kissler and some others. And so I think it's both sides. It's the ability to say what you're going to get experientially here is what you want. This is the best fit for you. That's one element of how they've won in recruiting. And then the other element has been this nice job of rounding out their class. Everybody wanted Colin Molsheim, like, and they got him, right? That's not, you know, that's not necessary. I mean, that's one type of win, but it's not the same as, you know, a guy who maybe most of his other options were high level Patriot League or, you know, high level CAA, whatever it might be. And then Princeton, right? And you're going to win that battle 95% of the time. And so I think that it's just so reflected in the talent, and it's diversified talent. They have legitimate depth at midfield, right? So you can get scoring production from nine guys, and you don't have to, you know, just think about the role that Sean Cameron plays. You know, it must have been a really fun day for his family, given, you know, his brother played at Carolina, his dad played at Carolina, and everything went like that, and he scores, you know. And so I just think that there's so much about the way that Matt Madeline and his staff have gone about constructing this group, especially when you consider that, you know, Penn has been able to keep all their guys for their additional year of eligibility. Some of these other programs, whether it be Cornell or Yale, have been able to extract an additional year of eligibility as well. Princeton has not. So, I mean, they were playing against the goalie who was the number one ranked goalie in the class when he came out, and they won. And so I just, you know, Largan, I don't know if you have any more thoughts on the nuts and bolts of the game, but I just watched it just kind of continuously thinking about, wow, it is so impressive that they have put together this collection of talent.
I think that's really well said. I think just to double click on that, and then I can go to game highlights. But Princeton's ability to string together the Schreiber era, where it was a huge disappointment, obviously, with in terms of like tournament results with one of, you know, maybe the best player of the last 20, 30 years, into Sowers and now building through Mackesy and Kibiri and what that does. You know, they have the best strength of schedule in the Ivy, in my opinion, which is a huge interest point for recruits. Ultimately, they're built on a foundation of tyranny in the championships, but it's not any fun, and it's really hard. Like, I don't think people really realize how much harder Princeton is than Brown. It's like not even in the same universe. So it's highly frustrating for me as a passionate, you know, fan of obviously one of their in-league rivals. And, you know, ultimately there's like 10 players on their offense who would be the best player on ours. So they're winning battles. I think Madelon's done a great job in his assistant coach selection as well as development. You know, when March left, it was, you know, they picked it right up and didn't miss a beat. And ultimately they've put themselves in a great spot now because of, in my opinion, the Ivy's down. They should roll through it other than the Cornell result. And as long as Cornell's RPI is high enough, that won't really impact them either way. So, you know, ultimately Princeton, the first 4 weeks of their season determines their season in many ways because they open with big dogs. I mean, there's no cupcakes. They kind of have to go 2-2 or else they're in trouble. But yeah, in terms of like structurally, I think anytime you have a lefty and a righty who can complement each other the way, I mean, the rumors in the league are that Nate Kibiri is like legit. And I really think highly of Mackesy. So ultimately, if you can get stops and you can survive in the specialties, right, you're going to be in a really good position to be competitive late against great teams. And I think that what will be interesting for Princeton is they try and take that step from competitive to, let's call it, the elite tier of the Maryland's and Notre Dame's, is can an on-ball athlete on the back end develop to the point where they don't need to slide to X, right? And I think the short stick D-middy position at Princeton, Achilles heel is the wrong term because I think they're actually quite good in most of their games. So let's say, you know, when they play Harvard, I don't think the short stick D-middies will stand out negatively. But I think the second they go to a Maryland or a Notre Dame in, say, the semifinal, I think Tillman circles those guys, puts them on islands, and makes them make decisions off razor picks. So, you know, this was a classic matchup that will determine seeding in May, right? This is how you go from, like, a 4 seed to an 8 seed as you get clipped here. But both teams are good, and I just enjoyed watching, you know, the whole weekend of ball. It was great.
So we've had a lot of high-level conversations here. Allow me to dumb it down a little bit. Was this the sexiest shot matchup of the year?
100%.
With Petro highlight and McAtee? The highlights that were coming out of this game were the, I'm just going to say it, the sexiest highlights that you could possibly hope for. The corners were just stung. There were, you know, the wet net that had the poof of mist coming after it. My goodness. I mean, if you haven't seen it, go and just watch some of the highlights of this game, because the low to high strokes that these guys were taking, it is, I mean, Larkin, as a golf analogy, I just, before I go and play a round, I just search best flop shots of all time and go and try and emulate that. Before I play a men's league game, I'm going to refer back to this game so that I can, you know, get in the low to high, bar down, poof of mist mindset. And I'm curious if there's even another matchup that I'm excited to watch after this one, because my goodness, it was just a beautiful thing.
Well, yeah. So the stroke is obviously incredible. I mean, Don Petromala is. But my thing is the BDBs, and I don't know why I said it that way. The BTBs. You got to be more enunciated, otherwise it sounds like you're talking about a BB gun
behind the back.
One more time.
Behind the back. Hey, yeah, I'm exactly. Walking here.
There was one Princeton sequence in which there was a behind the back that either got saved or deflected, and then the other Tiger came up with a ground ball on the doorstep and finished it behind the back, like a multi-sequence, unintentional, unlinked together. Because you see that sometimes, right? Like the BTB assist to the BTB goal. This was not that. This was a, like, it's a one-goal game because, as Nick pointed out, it never got more beyond 2 goals, and we're just in the backyard coming up with whatever we've got. So, no, I'm going to declare it the sexiest highlight matchup of the season. Also, love the orange jerseys with the black shorts. That is such a good look.
And, Larkin, let's touch on this for about, I don't know, 3 minutes or so. How lucky are we that we played in the era that we did? Because, you know, again, I don't know how quickly lacrosse advanced throughout the 2000s. When we were in college, it was roughly 2011 to roughly 2016. And we kind of saw, oh, Lyle Thompson initiate this, you know, backyard play with a sense of swagger and stick skills and just essentially the balls to go and make plays at a Division I and professional level. I'm watching every single year, and I think it really started in about 2021, I would say. I can't do in the backyard what these guys are doing in games. It's actually ridiculous. So when, you know, when I have kids and they're saying, yeah, dad played pro lacrosse, I'm going to not even show them any of the highlights from my era. I'm just going to go, look at what these guys are doing now. Yeah, that's what I did. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, both these offenses are ridiculous. Interestingly, it'll be their defenses that determine how far they go in May. As a quick call out, both Army and North Carolina now have 3 more or less cupcakes, so we have a gargantuan matchup in about 3-ish weeks with the 7-1 Carolina realistically at 8-0 Army, which will be fun. But yeah, well said, Nick.
I want to make you guys feel good and just talk about not skill, but pure athleticism. Jackson Green now in consecutive games has either run over somebody or just run around everybody to end the clock, which in my opinion, it's like one of my favorite skills. It's kind of like a, you can only use this every once in a while. I remember watching Logan Ipp, Harvard midfielder now, when he was in high school, and I was like, he can do a lot of things, but the thing that he can do better than anything else is if you're up a goal with like 25 seconds left, he can run around until the other 7 defenders are tired and can't chase him anymore. There was a Virginia at Navy game in the Bratton era, where Ramel Bratton, and this was pre-shot clock, so I don't know how much time was left, but a lot, just literally ran two full circles, two laps around the restraining box. And for me, as a result, that he has been the best, like, kill a game player since I saw that happen. Jackson Green is giving him a run for his money. That dude is an athlete. He like appears nowhere in the inside lacrosse recruiting database. So my assumption, he's a sophomore, is that he went to Princeton to play football and then walked onto the lacrosse team. And he played a little bit last year. But you know, I know he was really, really pivotal in one of their early season wins. I think it was the Penn State game. And now, showed out and put highlights on tape against
that clip from Friday. Juice goal. I mean, that was unbelievable. And I love that it's an Ivy kid running over an ACC athlete too.
Yeah, ACC athlete was off balance, but, you know, it is what it is. Terry, quick question, sidebar. Choose the prime of primes, my prime, Larkin's prime. 45 seconds left on the clock. He's out on me. How do you think that game ends?
Well, hopefully you're up one because he is absolutely going to –
Yeah, we're up one.
To...
He's got to kill the clock.
Yeah, no, he's going to strip you, and then he's going to pick up a ground ball. Bring it down, look off the slide man, and then shoot like 3 yards over the top of the crossbar.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. I was actually going to say Nick's going to split the double. Corrigan had specifically told him not to shoot it in the empty net. He's going to like go to shoot. It's going to hit the pipe, go the other way.
You're
going to
get the ground ball.
Yeah, exactly. Something like that.
You had so many of those Notre Dame comebacks. All right, guys, do this. No, we'll just give the ball to the, you know, Serbian who's from Detroit and watch him do what he does. And it's probably not Serbian, and there's probably some Balkan reference that I'm going to get an angry call about. So sorry, Sergio, wherever you are from, I'm on your team. So any other thoughts on Princeton UNC before moving on?
No.
No.
I'm going to start doing a who was the USC then LSU national championship winning football coach? Go Tigers.
Ed Orgeron?
Oh, Ed Orgeron.
Yes. I need to do that. I'm going to get an Ed Orgeron gif. I'm just going to tweet that every time Princeton wins. Go Tigers.
Now, we've had a wonderful slate of expected great matchups. I think the biggest question mark was, can Richmond hang with Cornell? Boy, did they answer that with an emphatic yes. They kind of let the game slip away. So this game ended about 10 minutes before we started recording. But they jumped out to a 6-1 lead and had Cornell on the ropes for the entire game. Now, fourth quarter, they had some bad decisions. They had a couple chances to put it away. They had a couple chances to not let Cornell claw their way back, but Cornell ultimately did. Final score was 12-11. Richmond now with losses to Maryland and Cornell, but wins over Virginia, Lehigh, and Bobby Moe. It was Cornell's first close game of the season. Usually I toss it to Terry, but Larkin, let's start with you. What are your live reactions to this game?
So I was surprised. This was a game in which I respect Richmond, but because of the film on UVA, I think there was a little bit more mystery associated with how quality they are. Like, I think ultimately they play in the A-10. Most people expect them to win the A-10. But does that mean they can really compete with, let's say, a Final Four quality roster and look the part athletically? I think is... let's call it year over year up for debate typically. So I think what I learned from them today is that they're a team that when they win the A-10 will want to be avoided in the first round. Like, I think Chamati has a good group. I think that they make strong on-ball strategic decisions on offense. They don't piss the rock away. They put their athletes in space. I'm not surprised that Cornell inevitably won, but I do think that I would argue both the gap between Notre Dame and Maryland and Cornell is perhaps slightly larger than I gave credit to, as well as, you know, ultimately Richmond is a rhubarb. And I think that Dan Chamati is probably my number one in terms of the next time a very big job opens, I could see the athletic director getting on the plane and making him say no. Like, I think he's earned the respect of the nation, in his consistency. I think year in, year out, they're just well coached and they, you know, give good rosters trouble. It was just a fun game to watch.
And Terry and I earlier, I think it might've been week 0 or 1. We kind of looped Richmond, High Point, Jacksonville in on those not necessarily giant killers, but giant worriers. Seems like Richmond has certainly solidified themselves, at least the 2025 flavor of you better watch out when they're on the radar. Terry, what did we learn?
I'm not as surprised as Larkin for both ends of the spectrum. I meant to text you after last week's podcast. Like, one of the core distinctions that you, about the way that you and I see this is I did see there being a little bit of a more sizable gap between two and three. I was right there with you that Cornell was very clearly and solidly three, but I do think that there are some, you know, notable flaws in this team that I think were present in that first quarter. And what's interesting is that there was a lot about the way that that first quarter unfolded that was very similar to the way that their Hobart game in week unfolded as well. And I think the reason that the, you know, second quarter and then the second half unfolded the way that it did is because Richmond is better than Hobart. I think that the element that I'm going to want to look at more closely is the job that Michael Farrell did guarding CJ Kirst, holding him to, I believe, two goals and two assists. And then Mitchell Dunham, he's a Mount St. Mary transfer, and there have been a number of grad transfers that have come out of Mount St. Mary's with gaudy production numbers, particularly at the defensive end of the field, ground balls and caused turnover numbers. And then those numbers have translated disproportionately at Richmond, coincidentally. And I think that's a really kind of, I don't know, I want to look at that a little bit more closely. This Richmond offense has 5-6 guys that they can rely on in ways that are more democratized than the Dalton Young, Ryan Lanchberry-led Richmond offenses. And I think that makes them more difficult to game plan for. So when you compound that with the fact that, you know, Cornell's defensive end of the field is where there are more questions, both in terms of injury personnel and also in terms of 2020 for production, although I think that they've got a little bit more solid goalie play this year than they did last year. And that's offset by the fact that with the return of Jack Escadden from injury, Cornell has been facing off very well. So I think that I am going to put a lot of stock in the Michael Myers nature of Cornell's unwillingness to go away. And I thought that it was really emblemized in the game-winning goal when a ball bounces out to 27 and he's there for the opportunistic step down when Richmond had earned the stop. And then I think it was on the possession prior when Richmond had done such a nice job off ball. Shout out to Dan Kaplan for pointing this out in the inside of the cross Slack. Not letting... Basically, they were pre-switching in order to not let a shorty go to CJ in order to get that big little switch. And so as a result, they just had a very tight plan that complemented their personnel. I thought Zach Vigue had another really nice game. And so certainly you're going to be disappointed with the result because it felt like a game that you controlled and had an opportunity to win, especially because when you handle that counterpunch in the second quarter and you manage to slow the game down in the second half to the point where that counterpunch doesn't turn into a boulder rolling downhill, you feel like it's a game that you can win. And this is a team that has beaten ACC teams enough that they can expect to beat Cornell, right? In this situation, they are not a team where like they're what normally happens is they play well and then fall short. That has happened, of course, but you know, they beat Virginia earlier this year. I believe they've beaten Duke. They've definitely beaten Virginia prior years. So they know how to beat the best teams in the country, and they're not going to take a lot of consolation from a one goal loss at home on a Sunday in front of a nice energetic crowd against the Big Red.
And just to hold myself accountable, I think one of the reasons like my bull case on Cornell this year heading into the season was so high is I actually thought Willem Firth was going to take a huge sophomore step. And the rumor mill out of like Hill, Toronto, the box expertise was that he is, you know, he's not Jeff Teat, but he's like a next great Canadian, will be a huge compliment to Kirst.
Jeff Teat says he's the next Jeff Teat.
Right, right. And typically, like, they don't really lie about that stuff. Like, when you hear about the Westbergs or the Zach Millers or the whoever coming out of the summer indoor leagues, it's like they're all really good when Brody Merrill says they're good, or to use a metaphor. So in no way would I, like, take out my own money and leverage against his career. I just more mean, as of now, it's still like we have a primary ball carrier in Kirst, and teams will try to solve to stop him. And the rest of Cornell's offense, to me, is just highly complimentary, and it's a lot of, like, two A's, right? So that'll be interesting to track.
100%. I mean, for me, it feels like some of these NBA duos that you just imagine the Dame Giannis pick and roll, and it's going to, you know, account for 50, 60 points a game, and then it just doesn't manifest. And I felt like that lefty-lefty, especially if it was going to be a big little two-man action between CJ and Willem, was going to be like incredibly productive, and it just hasn't been. And there are a myriad of explanations as to why, but I'm with you in the sense that just because it hasn't been to this point doesn't mean that it can't be going forward. And if it is, then I think that's where your point about being bullish on them is really valid.
So I was only able to tune in halfway through the third quarter, so I didn't see Richmond's offense firing on all cylinders in the first. I think you learn the most about a team kind of when they're in crunch time. And as Cornell, you know, especially in the fourth quarter, it seemed like their game plan was just, we can be bigger, faster, stronger. So I guess I'm curious, what did I miss in the first half where I don't chalk this up as Richmond probably snuck out, maybe caught Cornell sleeping a little bit. Cornell realized who they were from an athleticism standpoint, particularly dodging, you know, not just with Kearse, but there were a couple goals where it was a late slide on Richmond or a non-existent slide. And just saying, I'm going to put my foot in the ground. I'm going to take 10 steps that way. Good luck stopping me. Do you think Richmond is a team that now that they're, you know, certainly on the radar of everybody, not just after the Virginia win, but after, you know, this game, are they going to be able to catch people sleeping? Is this an offense that can perform? Is this a defense that can perform when they're given the respect that they deserve?
Larkin, do you want to take it or do you want me to?
Well, the one thing we didn't see, so just to address for those who maybe didn't watch, you know, any of the film, it was not as if Richmond was hot on the clamp and got like super hot in cage. So let's take those variables off the table. I think it was more, I think Cornell had their B-minus game early with respect to like ball movement and decision-making at the point of attack. Like I thought they were just a little bit sticky, especially for their standard. And I actually really liked Richmond's back-end plan. Like I thought the way in which they slid and the amount of energy and focus in the backside hedge they were putting onto the lefties is the path to success. Like you have to complicate Kearse's day with just like mud in the waters inside. So the entire time I felt like Cornell was coming in the sense that I didn't think it was safe. Go ahead, Terry.
So In building the 6-1 lead, I thought that it was mid-range shooting. That was the way I saw it. They had four assisted goals. One of them, their third goal to go up 3-1, was off the face-off win. So Aiden O'Neill at the point of the fast break. But the two dodging goals were both out of midfielders who have been able to get their own, but definitely like attacking shorties in Merklinger and Sheridan. And I thought that beyond that, I was really impressed. Lucas Littlejohn was kind of the hero of that Virginia game in terms of his shooting, but he had two of those assists. And I thought that his willingness to move the ball was what stood out, and especially like, you know, find those 8 to 12 yard looks from the wings for uncovered shooting. And so to the point that you made about you didn't see them clicking on all cylinders, I think that what you saw, because I can imagine there are going to be games when Aiden O'Neill is going to be relatively uncoverable and he's just going to get what he wants. And so it's either going to be him getting to the dirt and then like, you know, throwing through a slide or just actually scoring. That was not what I saw in terms of when they were clicking. And so it was like a relatively standard ball movement in terms of, hunting particular matchups, trying to get leverage on a third of the instances they did and they converted. And then in terms of the way they scored the other four goals, one of them was off the fast break and the other three were, I thought, off of good ball movement.
Okay. Credit to Richmond. I'll go back and watch the first half and, maybe come back next week and critique your critique. Potentially.
There we go.
Moving along, Hopkins, Virginia. Their 99th meeting. Congrats to them on that. And I don't know, Terry. I don't know, Larkin. It just seems like this UVA offense has another significant sputter. I can't find the word for it. But my takeaway is, you know, they were held for a 20-minute scoring drought, or roughly 20 minutes. Meanwhile, Chavette's on the other end scoring five. And the story to me, in the same way that Notre Dame kind of needs to tighten up the decision making, particularly in crunch time and particularly in transition and early offense. It seems like there were big moments that UVA could have capitalized on, and credit to Hopkins for, you know, playing relatively quality defense, but this was a bigger head scratch for UVA's decision making, from my perspective, than it was anything else. A bad pass out of bounds from a pull to a midi that was near the sidelines. A low shot angle that wasn't the right shot to take as they looked to mount, a victorious comeback. So Hopkins, I just feel like, is an enigma. They're always going to play close games. We know a little bit about them. The question mark for me is, can UVA tighten up their decision making? Is that the right takeaway, Terry?
So I want to concede that I was only able to watch the goals. So 25 goals. I don't want to speak to the flow, but the point is, and the reason I wanted to start my comments with that is because, like, when you watch 25 goals in succession, you don't realize that they went 20 minutes without scoring. And so, you know, when I look at these games, you and I, Nick, have had this conversation, 13-12, we probably could have talked about it within the context of Notre Dame, Maryland too. Like, you know, did Notre Dame lose because they gave up 11 or because they only scored 10, right? And I think that if you're Virginia, you know, did you lose because you gave up 13 to a Russell Melendez, by and large, less Johns Hopkins, or because you only got to 12 on Hopkins' defense? I think that if you're Kevin Cassis, there's a lot that you can take away that's really promising from this game. I mean, certainly you got your knowns activated in Sunderland and Millen in ways that you probably can be encouraged by, you know, to the extent that you probably deserve, or you have to give some credit to Hopkins' defense for limiting production. It would be Ryan Colsey, who was coming off of a really good game the week prior. So I think that the variety of scoring, right, like, you know, a lot of guys that hadn't put up even anything, much less like big numbers, got on the stat sheet in this one. Hackett got a goal. Balsamo got an assist. Menke got an assist. They also, you know, had their in Tommy Snyder and Anthony Gobriel. They both produced, so they had their, and Will Enderlead, so they had their transition component to it and their early offense component to it as well. But I think ultimately, you know, and one of the elements of this was kind of being around the Notre Dame and Maryland folks and talking to, you know, McNair, who covered the game kind of in real time. There was this expectation of a reversion, right? And I think that's what you saw in terms of the way that the game unfolded in the third quarter was kind of the way that people expected the game to unfold in total. And so, I don't know, man. Like, I'm starting to feel, I mean, I just said the things that were positive. If I were just going to convert it and be critical of Virginia now, I would just kind of say, like, I feel mean. Like, I've already said what I've had to say in terms of their inability to get looks and settled offense. And I think that this is an improvement and a step forward, but I still think that, like, it's not enough. They have to get more better.
Yeah. And Larkin, kind of question to you, it seemed like, you know, UVA showed up to Homewood wearing, you know, a turtleneck and saying, hey, do you mind helping us out with a win here? And Hopkins just kind of bullied them and said, no, we're not going to give you a win. You know, what's your takeaway here?
I think the one statistic I'd point to for, like, UVA fans or broader fans who don't watch every game as a way to track whether their offense is gaining better structure and more efficiency is Millen shooting 12 times is not a path to success for UVA. The polls are too good on their schedule, and the implication is that the middies aren't doing a good enough job of creating up, you know, kind of above the cage slide decisions that will allow him to, like, hockey assist, right, to kind of spin and move the rock south north. Like, ultimately, I actually think the national treatment of Millen is somewhat unfair in that he's being asked to do a lot. And similar to Duffy for UNC last year on a pretty average group, right? Like, Duffy ultimately late in clock would just have to go one-on-one on, like, all Americans. And so, you know, and I think Terry and I talked about it at length. Like, ultimately, the remedy for Kevin Cassis is there's three or four midfielders who need to take a big step, and quite literally a step in terms of, like, downfield leverage. But just, like, as something to point to, and I'm sure Lars is kicking himself, I think there's, like, 50 seconds left. They're man up, down two. They have to run something to get a shot with, like, 35 seconds still on the clock so that they can go to the faceoff X. And if they lose the faceoff, have enough time to double down. Or if they win the faceoff, be able to call timeout if they had one and set something up. Like, no matter what, that ball's got to go below GLE, through X, and they have to either feed the seal slip or feed the guy over the top, and he's got to shoot it from 18. Like, that is high school coaching. They literally, like, passed it in a circle and got bailed out when it went near side or far side sideline, and I think Sunderland had kind of, like, a bizarre little bit of leverage in the crease, ended up losing by one. But that's just something to point towards where I know Lars, like, he's a great coach. They're going to, you know, those are mistakes they don't make. They haven't made in years. So it just gets back to this theme of they're a little bit off, like something in the room, something with the leadership core. I don't know what it is, but ultimately I think Virginia, like, they need to make a decision here whether they want this to be like a 4-10 type year or whether they want to kind of try and battle through the ACC back to some path to respectability and perhaps tournament berth. But it's tough to watch. I will say, just to flip the script, I'm getting a little bit nervous about Hopkins in their inability. Like, if they are truly a great team, this is the type of event where they need to, like, put their, you know, put their foot on UVA's throat and, like, land a knockout punch. And I get a little bit nervous about them playing down. And,
like, well, let me be clear. They are not great.
Right.
I don't even think that they have a path to greatness. I think that they are very good. And I think that they have a path to the Final Four because the field has come back. I think that they and Carolina are the emblems for, like, Carolina. This year's Carolina team beats last year's Carolina team, but it's not as one-sided.
Yeah. That's a good point.
Last year's Hawkins team beats this year's Hawkins team. That being said, I am more confident this year's Hawkins team getting to the Final Four than I was either of the last 2 years.
That's a good point. Like, your point basically that UVA, Duke, et cetera, have just taken a step back. And because of that, it's opened up that 3-8 range. Yeah, no, I like that. And strategically, I thought, just to chirp Lars' defense a little bit, Hopkins did a really good job of kind of high pair left alley, putting the backside poles in, like, long slide decisions. And with how good Chauvet's stroke is, it's just, like, really hard to play that 2v2. And I think that Hopkins will continue to do that. So, like, look at that high pick in that left alley as a way, even if the front side doesn't work, as a way to spring backside action. So I think Milman's just going to keep going back to the hoop on that.
All right, moving on. We kind of have, like, the last three and then open topic. So we touched on it earlier, but Princeton takes down Duke 15-14. Carolina beats Penn 16-8. Duke beats Penn 11-5. And Zielinski met with Trump and Vance. So kind of those four topics, however you guys want to approach it, Terry, we'll kick to you first.
Yeah, I thought that the Oval Office meeting was really an interesting insight into Marco Rubio's approach to conflict. and so I think he's got some strong takes on how Penn's offense can really identify the best path for Leo Hoffman to use his explosive first step in order to draw a lot of attention upfield. I thought that Penn's first game or first goal of the game against Duke was a really good illustration of number 50, kind of, because he's such a dual-handed threat, and he's a bunny rabbit, and so it was a top right, well, I guess to the goalie's top left, but his top right, and you're just so worried about him getting underneath and S dodging to the middle, but he ends up going over the top, and then he has a nice lefty feed to a righty cutter coming through, and it was just like a very easy finish. And so, you know, obviously they've got some injuries in their starting attack, you know, but at the same time, you would hope to put up more than five on this Duke defense. And so I think for the Quakers, you know, it's starting to look like Ivy League AQ or bust coming off this weekend.
I'm happy to actually talk politics if you want to. I don't think we do, but because of the amount of Syracuse fans who I'm sure listen to this, I'd like to draw one corollary. I thought the two most interesting results, Marquette scoring 16 on Harvard, I think is a huge concern if you're a Cuse faithful. Like, I don't know if Harvard's any good. And so I think that's one red flag I'd like to put in the air for the Orange and Gary Gate. And the second, because I actually think that they've earned the right for us to talk about this, the Yale erosion in real time is, like, crazy. You know,
did you see what they did with their starting attack?
I did, which I actually kind of love.
Yeah.
The part that's...
Well, explain it. Maybe people listening.
Three new starters. Lyons and Johnson not on the field.
Wholesale.
Yeah.
Everything must go.
And so it was Brad Sharp, a midfielder who missed last year with the ACL tear, and then Connor Gately, the freshman, and Carson Cool, who was one of the starting attackmen last year, filling in for probably the Leo Johnson role more than anything else. But they went back to him, and Leo and Lyons went back in at attack, I think, in the second quarter.
And I think in the Kemp report, I put them both in the Joe Namath, like, must show a pulse. So the part that's surprising about the Yale thing is not the result. Like, I think Penn State's a good team. I don't think Yale's that good this year, whatever it is, what it is. It's more just that, like, we all have a lot of respect for Andy Shea. I would have, like, put my entire life savings on, like, a Yale first quarter come out punching body blows, like, showing some pop on the back end, energy in the building, like, to use hockey. Like, it was just, oh, Penn State's up, like, you know, 9-1. Here it is. I think that.
Well, Larkin, I think there's one thing that makes it even more confusing, which is that they beat Carolina pretty handily in the fall.
It's not,
we're not making this up. We're not pulling this out of thin air. Like,
right.
The 22 season, you know, I look to the extent that people paid attention to it, which nobody does because there's no hot takes affirmed Twitter account. But, like, I was right on my Ivy League projection exclusively because I paid attention to the results in the fall. And, you know, Penn beat Navy 20-5 and Cornell beat Maryland and Yale destroyed Syracuse. And, like, all these other things, they mattered. And so I'm just very confused why the Carolina-Yale result, we've seen Carolina go on and have a good start to the season. Yale is 0-3 and has been lifeless in two games. It's so head-scratching.
It really is. And I think the amount of texts I'm getting inbounds about it from, like, college coaches, et cetera, I think it's one of the real themes to watch here is kind of what plays out in New Haven the rest of the year. And then I had one more just side comment I wanted to make. Colgate's offense.
Oh, you stole mine. That was my goodie bag read.
Oh, then you go. You go. Go ahead.
I love Carwick. I love the juice that Colgate has shown consistently. They're allergic to close games. They start off with, you know, pretty big losses to Penn State and UVA. Bounce back against Albany. And then it was Harvard, Nova, and Loyola. And their last two games were won by 11 and 12 goals. So I love teams that, even if you just look at their schedule, you see the momentum building. Their next big game, they have Bucknell and Lafayette as their next two, but Cuse after that. And they also have Navy and Army on the schedule. I'm tuning into those games. I think Colgate could kind of slip into that conversation where we talk about High Point, Richmond, and Jacksonville. I think Colgate's going to be kind of the next emerging. You can't not pay attention to these guys. They had big upset against Penn State last year. So I love what Colgate's doing. I love what Carwick's doing. They got an Idaho kid, Wiley Warshall on the roster. Love it. Bye, Colgate stock.
I think it's also just a good example of, like, an athletic director sticking with a coach who I think the kids probably love. Like, everything I hear from the Notre Dame boys, and not that I have a lot of, like, adjacencies to Colgate alumni, but – you know, ultimately, like, he was...
Brandon Corbett's not in your DMs?
Yeah. I mean, if you go look at his record at Colgate, like, it is... You, like, lose your job over that type of both in-league and out-of-conference record. I think he was, like, 22-47 heading into the year. Like, at one point during the Murphy and Nagel eras, like, they were making tournaments. They won a Toronton. Like, they're... I mean, Colgate is not Holy Cross, put differently. So, ton of respect to those guys. And... listen, like, do I think Army's really good? Yeah. Do I think that if Colgate keeps trending the way they are, could they hypothetically beat them in the Patriot League tournament? Maybe. So I think that it's something to keep an eye on, and it could be one of the feel-good stories of the spring.
One of the feel-good stories from Saturday is my goodie bag and pull, and it was also in the Patriot League. BU goes down to Annapolis, which they just can't beat Navy, so that wasn't a surprise. But it was impressive that Navy was able to go in without Zach Hayashi, who got hurt against Penn State, and keep an eye on that injury because he went down. It looked like a sniper got him, and those are never good-looking injuries. And then Colin Shadowins, who got the start, took a big hit after the first faceoff and was out for the rest of the game. So they had to turn to a walk-on faceoff guy who apparently started at RIT and then transferred to the academy and played on the club team the last 2 years, Joey Bucci, which is a great name straight up, but it's also a good name because Joe Bucci, former inside lacrosse intern, is the defensive coordinator at Penn State, who he would have played against last week, comes in relief and wins 6 of 11 and gives tremendous juice to his team as they built a big lead and held on to a significant win over a Boston U team that is certainly a contender for a Patriot League tournament spot that the midshipmen are chasing. So that was my poll of the weekend.
Final poll of the weekend. What a year for Italian names. GM Ficcaro, Riccardelli, Joey Bag of Donuts for Navy. There's a pretty good spread, if you will, of little antipasti sprinkled into the rosters of the Division I lacrosse world. And I love that, and I think we need to see more of it. Italian representation is important. How you doing, Larkin?
I agree. As a proud Irishman. With an Irish cast, I agree that Italian representation is important.
Our day of the year is coming up here, Nico.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Anything else before we wrap this up? This has been fun. The three-man weave. I was kind of curious how it was going to go, but I mean, hate to say it, Larkin, you've elevated the depth of conversation on this. Maybe that wasn't my role to play ever, but happy to feed you the rock and watch you shoot it 3 yards over the net.
Larkin, you bring the best out of Nick.
Hell yeah, love it. We gotta do this in person sometime, boys.
Dude, so bad. I haven't seen you in person
Final Four live
too
show.
Long.
Could be real.
Final Four live show, no doubt about it. Maryland Notre Dame national championship game. We know who's gonna be on each side.
Yeah, let's hope Notre Dame makes it. Whoa.
Whoa. Hey.
They're really easy. Good. I'm kidding. Easy, fella.
All right, well, as we wrap up, as we always do, and I mean it. Love you.
Perfect time for your mic to drop out. Love you more, Nick. Love you, Larkin.
See you, boys.
No! Oh, shit.